It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod, recorded February 9th, 2024. And this time in the pod, we're continuing our effort to talk with each of the candidates for supervisor in Napa County. Today, it's Doris Gentry. Welcome to the Barry Pod.
Well, good morning, Barry. It's so nice to be here today. I feel like I've come home back in the studio.
So let's talk a little bit about Doris Gentry. Give us your basic reasons why voters should choose you in District 2.
Well, I think I have a depth of knowledge and information that can be a tremendous asset to the county board. I've done a lot of county board work, and particularly, I really love Napa. I've been here a long time, invested, and worked hard to build Napa as a place that people love and want to go to, and I've been a supporter of Napa for all the years that I've been here.
So there's an array of issues that are sort of the fundamental questions for a supervisor candidate, and I want to cover as many of those as we can in the time we have. But before we get into those specific things, would you agree with the statement that you're probably the most controversial politician Napa has seen in 50 years?
I don't see myself as controversial. I'm not sure why do you see me as controversial?
There have been a lot of issues that when you were on the city council that sort of a maelstrom of worry circled around you, from issues about the pride flag, for example. Don't you think that was controversial?
The issue of the pride flag was a complete erroneous issue. The issue of the pride flag was completely erroneous because I wanted the American flag to have a sovereign position on its own flagpole, and I wanted a separate flagpole for the pride flag. I did not disagree about hanging a pride flag. I did not disagree about hanging a flag for another concept, whatever that concept would be. I was not opposing pride or the pride flag. I was opposing hanging it on the American flagpole. And I argued that we needed a flagpole that celebrated community issues, community concerns, community desires, whatever the organization is that has their own flag. And so I voted no. And everybody ran out of the room. Everybody was in the room and they heard me very clearly saying that. And even the Napa Register on the front page advertised it correctly, saying Doris Gentry opposed hanging the pride flag on the sovereign American flagpole. Even the paper got it correct, but the entire pride community wailed that I had done it wrongly because I did say no to the pride flag. In that next year, we did get the second flagpole up, and the next year when the vote came around, I voted yes. It was 5-0. I voted yes to hang the pride flag on its own separate flagpole. So things get misconstrued and people run off henny-penny with a concept and it's not accurate.
Someone listening to this who's a member of the LGBTQ community or an ally of that community remembers those incidents and what was going on at that time. What would you say to those folks right now to win their vote?
I would say to them that I have always been an advocate of the LGBTQ community. I grew up with a mother that was bisexual. I grew up with a sister that was gay. I grew up, and my daughter is gay, and my daughter is married to her person. When gay marriage became legal, we flew to Las Vegas and I participated in her wedding, and now she lives in South Carolina with her person that she's married to, and she's very happy. I have my oldest grandson who is gay. I think it would be very hard to say, oh my gosh, Doris, you're a gay hater, when my entire world is surrounded by family and loved ones for my entire life. I mean, when my sister was gay my whole entire life and dragged me into gay nightclubs in Orange County where we had to sneak in the back door and dance when it was illegal, afraid we were going to get arrested, I think it would be hard pressed to call me a gay hater. Yet they do, and it's okay, because people get labeled as some kind of crazy white supremacist that hates gays, and that's how people label me, because I am a Christian, I am white, and so people want to slap a label on me, and that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. It's hard to crawl out of that hole once people dig me in it.
You mentioned being a Christian. Would you consider yourself a Christian nationalist?
I consider myself a person that loves other people. I consider myself a person that loves God. I consider myself a person that's kind and believes in the rights of others and the individual rights of others to choose their way and to be non-judgmental of other people. I consider myself a person that allows others to live their life in their way. I live my life in my way, and I want you, Barry, to live your life in your way. And I don't know what your way is, but I know for my way is the family way, and my way is to go to church. But as you know, there are many kinds of churches. There are many churches, and there are many ways. See, people worship God at home. People read the Bible. People meditate. People pray. There are many kinds of ways, but my own private faith is a faith of God and church and worship, and that's who I am. I try not to judge other people.
That having been said, the question I asked was, do you consider yourself a Christian nationalist, Christian nationalists usually believe in white supremacy. They believe that the United States should be a Christian nation and that other religions don't have the same legitimacy. Do you have any of those beliefs?
No, I don't believe in that. Mm-hmm. No.
The reason this comes up, of course, is because the other big controversy that you're associated with in 2020 was associating with someone who was Proud Boy adjacent. Ben Bergquam, if I'm not mistaken, is his name. He's got quite a reputation in that world of Christian nationalism. You posed with photos with him. You seem to be campaigning around that identity or that connection.
Barry, I went to a party at a person's house. Thank you for bringing this up. A person had a party for me at their home, and they invited people, including Ben. They invited Ben. I went to the house, and I did not know Ben. I did not invite Ben. I arrived. I was sitting at a table beside Ben. I shook his hand. He shook mine. I did not know Ben. I did not know Ben's background or who Ben was. And Ben was the speaker at the event that I was also a speaker. It was my event. And I spoke because I was running. And then Ben spoke. But I personally did not know Ben or his background until he spoke. And then when he spoke, I realized who he was and what he stood for and his background. It was not known to me before then. So I was not associated with him, a member of his. I mean, it's like saying that I went to a family dinner at a restaurant where everybody sits at a group table, and I sit down beside somebody that's a member of the KKK, and now I'm a member of the KKK. That doesn't make me a member or a supporter.
In fairness, though, a family dinner is not a political event, a fundraiser, I assume.
The person was invited, but I did not invite them. Mm-hmm. The person was there, and I did not know them. Mm-hmm. I met them. So I could have thrown down my pamphlets and stormed out of the room, but it was an event for me by a hostess, and I did not know this person. Now, since then, I've also been told that person was not a member of the Proud Boys. I've also been told that person is a member of the Proud Boys, so I don't really know. I don't know that person. I don't have them in my Rolodex. I don't have their cell phone. I never called to personally ask them. I've never talked to them again. I've never seen them again. It was a one and done. I left the party and it was over. To call me associated, affiliated, or a member of that group is absolutely ludicrous.
Do you regret that moment?
Well, how can I regret it? I walked into a party and the person was there. I sat down at a table and did not know that person. So no, I don't regret it. I went to a party. I mean, if you go to a party and someone's there that's of an opposite belief of you and you don't know it, and you're at a party and then you leave, how can you say, I regret I went to that party? I mean, that would not be right.
And yet, you describe it as a party, but it was a campaign event for you.
For me, held by a hostess mm-hmm. who was at her home, and she invited mm-hmm. the guests.
I guess some candidates would say, I wish I had vetted who was coming to that event, who was going to speak.
Well, I certainly
did after
that.
Because you do become associated.
Yeah. Okay. I certainly did after that, Barry. You are correct there. I did make some changes after that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get into some of those basic issues, as I mentioned, that every candidate has been addressing. We talked about these at the forum a couple of weeks ago now. And I think we really have to lead off with housing, the issue that keeps coming back to the top over and over again. And in some cases, homelessness and housing are connected issues. Talk about, if you can, what you would propose, what you would specifically want to do to try to address our constant housing crisis, affordability of housing, and of course, what we need to do to get people off the streets.
Well, for housing has to happen in the cities. The county is not prepared for housing. The cities are prepared for housing. Cities have the infrastructure. We have the roads, sewers, water, fire, police. The cities are prepared. Our five major cities are already equipped to provide us the housing and the housing opportunities that we need. And there's certain parts of each city that is better prepared for vertical housing, apartments and such. And there are other parts of the cities that are better prepared for single-use housing. So it makes perfect sense that the cities would absorb the housing that is needed. The intersection of government and business needs to take place in the cities. And the homeless are not sprawled out in the county. You do not see homeless rolling around about in the vineyards. The homeless are in the cities because that is where they can get their services. So it is not a county issue, it is a city's issue. And the counties do need to support the cities in the housing structure situation. But it is mostly a city's issue for solving the housing problem.
And as you know, for a very long time, the county and the cities have worked together to do, as you described, put housing in urban areas so we don't invade the agricultural areas and so on. That's been a traditional approach. But that requires some kind of collaboration, some kind of trade-offs, I would assume, that the city has to get something in return for that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the cities are required to build the houses. They're required to absorb the housing mandates. ABAG tells them what the housing requirements are. We are given a housing requirement and they're required to build the housing. So what trade-offs would the county provide? What trade-offs does the county have to do beyond roads and fire mitigation and things like that? I mean, we need to provide support for ingress, egress, and such, but there's not much the county can do. How does the county provide agricultural support to support housing?
So, as I was saying, the keeping housing in urban areas has been through agreements between the county and the cities. The cities are not required to take the county's allocation. You know that, right? So you get to a point where all of the potentially buildable places for housing in the cities are taken, and that will come. It's not in the next 4 years, but at some point there won't be any place to do this any longer. What then? When you get to something that the county has to work with in the unincorporated areas.
So when you're talking about that, you're talking about forcing the county to use county land for housing. I don't support that idea. The county land is for agriculture, urban development, open space. The county land is not for housing. It does not have the means to support housing. So somehow the county has to negotiate and work with the cities to build and grow what is needed for housing. American Canyon is a perfect example. They're doing a really great job, but everybody's complaining about the traffic. Immediately, everybody is complaining, oh my gosh, here go another 4,000 units or 4,000 apartments. Look at all the cars that's going to put on the road. Well, then American Canyon says, oh no, we're not putting cars on the road. All those cars are feeding in from Upper Napa County. They're not coming from American Canyon. We're starting right here and going out. So there has to be some sort of negotiation and conversation. And I think traffic and transportation is really the biggest question.
I want to come back to traffic and transportation in a moment, but let's talk about vineyard development. I've referenced in the other interviews with candidates that there seems to have been a sort of change of the tide in terms of attitudes toward maybe use the term glibly approving vineyard proposals, and this La Colline project feels like it changed the game. And the other one that I reference is the Walt Ranch outcome, where a long protracted fight, and it seemed as if the Hall family decided this is not winnable potentially, and went a different route with that property that they had acquired. I don't mean to speak for them. I don't have that on the record, but it's just an assumption, a mood that I'm talking about. In regard to the La Colline project, let's be specific. Would you have voted to approve that vineyard development that became a kind of a lightning rod?
I would have definitely voted to approve La Colline. I think the La Colline project, I think any time a business has spent 10 years and thousands of dollars, jumped through all the hoops and received the approvals, that is the due diligence. Do we not want a business to do the due diligence? We have enough businesses skipping due diligence, sneaking behind the grid and just doing stuff and then paying fines in the background. Just going ahead and doing an expansion and saying, oh, I'm sorry, charge me $200,000 fine. La Colline went through the hoops. La Colline went above and beyond. La Colline jumped through the hoops. La Colline was transparent, 100% upfront, and the county pulled the rug out from under them at the last minute. I think it was sneaky and terrible. And here's the worst part of it. I think it put terror on the backs of every other farming business in Napa County. And Barry Martin, every one of our farming communities, every one of our ranchers and vineyards of Napa County, do they not already own vineyards and ranches in other counties? Do they not already own ranches and vineyards in Sonoma, Solano, Fresno, Stockton? They're huge ranches. They own vineyards in other places. Why try to invest in Napa? Why even try to invest in Napa? What have we potentially lost in our future of Napa because of this little thing? It's not a little thing. For our future, it's potentially a very big thing. And if we don't develop open transparency on the part of Napa County government as in their approach to working with business, shame on us. And for the city council to have even weighed in on this, I know the city council, the mayor, and Mary Lurles and Liz Alicia wrote a letter to oppose La Colleen. Why would the city council even weigh in on a county board decision? I think this was a travesty all the way around. I'm very ashamed of our county board in this decision.
And I think you know that the city's perspective was the potential impact on city water supply.
Yes, yes, right? Yes, I know.
And for many of the people who have been opposed to that development or maybe opposed to other ones, they're looking at the watershed.
Yes,
it's not about deterring business. It's about healthy streams and rivers and global warming and a lot of other issues. Going forward, I remember at the forum at Copia, you did make a comment to the effect of the valley floor is essentially full and we need to go up the hillsides. That's where the real problems begin for a variety of reasons, runoff and the watershed, water quality and those things. Plus, what we hear the loudest are vineyard developments up narrow two-lane roads that may be dead ends. And if you add more vehicles to those roads and commercial activities, now you have a whole new fire danger question for people getting out when there is a fire threat and so on. To what degree should those things be considered? I don't want to paint you as believing that every proposal is provable.
I think every proposal is provable. I think every proposal should carry an answer to all of those questions. So if I put a proposal in and my road is going to block in everybody and nobody can get out with a fire issue, my proposal should include an answer to that, and I should carry the beast of that burden with my proposal. I should say, I'm going to build a back road and I'm going to carry the expense of that. And the county should very openly say, no way, I'm not going to approve this because you're going to create a fire blockade, blah, 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 blah. See, that's back to the open transparency. And the business says, well, that's going to add $1 million to my project. And the county says, well, I don't care. If you want to do this, you are going to have to prove that you can get people out in case of a fire. It can't be one way in, one way out. There's got to be a circular way. And you go, well, that's fair. Okay, I'll figure it out. I mean, that's the whole idea of open transparency. You tell the business what they must do, what must happen. I mean, how can Japan put rice paddies terraced on hillsides? I mean, that's water. They've got rice paddies on hillsides. France and Italy has vineyards on hillsides. If we're going to approve a few, I'm not saying 1,000, but a few more vineyards on hillsides, then For each application, we need to know what we will approve, how we will approve it on each individual application, and we need to say, oh, yeah, we'll approve this, but, and we need to say, you got to improve the road, you got to figure out a fire escape, blah, 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 blah. And then it's up to that person to go, whoa, you just added $10 million to our cost. And we go, well, I don't care. That's what you got to do if you want to do this. Now you decide if you're going to do it or not.
Since we got into the questions about fire prevention and mitigation, all that, there's an ongoing need at the county level for about $10 million a year to fund the approach that's been enacted recently. Where does that money come from is the question.
$10 million need to fund what?
A fire mitigation, reducing fuel loads, all this work that has been happening.
Okay, right. To clean the forests.
There was a proposal to put on a tax that failed, right? And then the next step is, well, where does that money come from? There have been a couple of thoughts suggested of where that funding might develop from within the county. So what do you think?
Okay, well, we do have a grant. We have a huge grant that we received to go in and clean the forests, and we haven't used that grant. And then the question was, once we use that grant, once we go in and clean the forest, how do we then continue to maintain everything? I think that was the question.
Yeah, exactly.
So my answer to that is, you, Barry, own this 100 acres right here, and if we use part of the grant money to go in and clean your forest floor and help your 100 acres be fire safe. Is that not a handout? Is that a handout? Was that a handout to you? If I take government money to your 100 acres and clean your forest floor, did I not just give you welfare? Yes, I did. Is it not then behooving on you to maintain your 100 acres every day after that?
So are you proposing that individual property owners be responsible for mitigating fuel loads?
Oh my gosh.
And
if the government goes in with this $60 million, $65 million grant, I mean, we're behind, right? And we want to save everybody. We do. So we go in there and we clean the forest floor and we do fire mitigation. We should, because we're behind. I get that. But after that, then we say to elderly Joe Smith and Jose Gomez, okay, now you go in there and you clean 1 acre a year or 5 acres a year and you keep it up. We have given you a gift. And if you need help, like the old-fashioned barn raising, you get 10 friends together and you keep this up. You owe it to us to sign a contract and say, I, the county, am going to give you this welfare. We're not going to call it welfare, but it is. I'm going to give you this gift and you maintain it from today forward. I think that's fair. Whether it's a vineyard owner or vineyard property, or whether it is Barry Martin's ranch. We owe it that you will then, in return, keep it up from then on.
All right. Running out of time already, and that tends to happen, but I want to ask a couple more questions and give you a chance for a closing statement. Fundraising totals were presented recently in the news a week or two ago.
Mine are anemic.
Reporting period. You reported a little under $5,000, of which $3,000 was a loan from yourself to your campaign. Your opponent had maybe $80,000 in that report. What does that say?
It says I'm anemic. So I got into the campaign late. I had people asking me all of 2023 to run. I said, no, I could not. I had a family member, close family member that I was caring for who was very sick, Alzheimer's, and I was not able to commit. I was not able to run. But at the very last minute, 1st of November, family members, my adult children stepped up and other resources came together, and I was able to say, okay, I'll step in the race. I will run. And I pulled papers on November 17th, 16th or 17th. And it was a shock to me that I did that. It was a complete shock. I had no money in the bank. I had no resources. I had nothing on November 16th or 17th when I pulled papers. But I did have something. I had everything. I had the supportive family and the supportive resources to say, we have your back, Doris, and you can run. So that's all I had. So I said, well, you know, when I ran for city council and when I ran for mayor, this city of Napa donated $300,000 in my campaigns. $135,000 for me to run for city council. And then when I ran for mayor, $165,000 for me to run for mayor. That is $300,000. And I said, you know, that's a lot of money. I'm not going to run out there and ask everybody for more money. Everybody knows my name, Doris Gentry. I currently have a live TV show. I was here on the radio for, I think, 9 years. People know my name. I did the chocolate and wine event. I hosted the Napa parade. People know my name. So I thought, I'm not going to run out there and ask people for $100,000 and put up yard signs. Instead, I'm going to call everybody in my district and say, hey, I'm Doris Gentry. I'm running for county board. I'd like to ask for your vote. And that's all we're doing. That's all we're doing.
Just to clarify, you said that the city of Napa had given you that money. You meant residents.
No. I mean, I raised for city council. I raised $135,000, and for mayor, I raised $165,000
from residents.
From residents, $300,000.
Could have been misinterpreted.
Oh, thank you, Barry.
Last minute or so here, closing statement: Doris Gentry, candidate for supervisor, District 2 in Napa County.
I just want to say that at one point in my life, there was a time I was a consultant to a 5-county planning commission. And as a consultant to the 5-county planning commission, I worked with these 5 counties and the cities in these 5 counties as a consultant and put together loan packages. And I helped the cities in these 5 counties and the counties themselves to get grants and loans. I put together packages to help them get money for their failing infrastructure. And I put these loans together, like $60, $80, and $100 million loans. And every year in the funding cycle, I would help to submit 3 to 5 loan applications. And they were for failing sewer systems, water systems, road systems. And we submitted applications that bundled money from HUD, CDBG block grants, cities, counties, citizens, residents, and local wealthy investors. And every time, every funding cycle, when we submitted these 3 to 5 loans, we always had 2 or 3 loans funded. And what that says about Doris Gentry, and this was a long time ago in Southern Illinois, what that says about Doris Gentry is I am extremely great at working with the intersection of government and business, counties and cities, and private investment, as well as working with the federal government, the state government, county money to obtain resources to help grow a city and a county and help to obtain resources to better a community. I've already been there. I've already done that. I've already done huge things like that. And I just can't wait to be elected to the Napa County Board and be a voice and help our Napa County to be continue to grow. We're an amazing Napa County. Amazing city, and I can't wait to be a part of it.
Doris Gentry, thank you for being here in the Berry Pod.
Yes, thank you, Barry.
This episode recorded on February the 9th, 2024.
You're listening to the Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.